We'll hear argument next, number 99-1884, Lackawanna County District Attorney versus South Carolina. Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, essentially involved in this case is the failure of the Third Circuit Court to apply the rationale espoused by this Court in Custis versus United States to conclude that constitutional deprivations other than deprivation of the right to counsel can be addressed in habeas corpus proceedings as constituting a collateral effect enhancing the sentence of someone in custody under a conviction that they are seeking to attack in the federal habeas corpus proceedings. In this case, Edward Koss had been convicted in the mid-80s of simple assault and institutional vandalism and had been sentenced to incarceration, and he'd completely served his sentence.
Had he filed an appeal from that conviction ever?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
A direct appeal?
Yes, he filed a direct appeal from that conviction.
And what happened? Does the record say what happened to the
direct? The conviction was affirmed.
And then he filed for state post-conviction relief?
He did, Your Honor.
On the inadequate assistance of counsel claim?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
And does the record tell us why the state courts never dealt with that?
No, the record does not tell us why the state courts did not deal with that. It just wasn't dealt with.
So we can assume that it may have been because the state court just neglected to get around to it?
That all assumptions are possible, and that certainly is one of them. It slipped through the cracks somehow, and I've not been able to determine how, Your Honor.
But you agree that the respondent was not at fault in failing to have the state court review that claim?
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, Your Honor, but because the respondent could have requested that the matter be brought up for a hearing, he just filed his post-conviction collateral petition, and then
there was an answer. I understood.
I don't think it was answered, Your Honor. An answer is not required under the Pennsylvania post-conviction unless
sat.
The court.
Then
it sat.
Sat.
He could have called it up, but in the meantime, his conviction, his sentence expired, and that's an equally reasonable inference as to why no action was taken, because he got out of jail, and the purpose
of — Well, but the conviction has subsequent consequences, as we see from this case, so it still could be a matter of significance.
Yes, it could be a matter of significance to that extent, Your Honor.
Was he entitled under Pennsylvania law, after release from custody, to continue the collateral attack on his conviction?
No, I believe, Your Honor, under the Pennsylvania law, he would have to be in custody to continue his attack on that conviction.
All right. So then at that point, there's nothing he can do to attack his conviction?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Do you have authority for that you've cited, that there is nothing that the Pennsylvania courts could have done at that juncture when he was out of custody?
Your Honor, I think that's to be found in the Pennsylvania Post-Conviction Relief Act. I think the requirement of custody is implicit in the act, or is
not just for filing,
expressed
but for resolving it,
for obtaining the relief. I I think it's in the Act, but I do know, Your Honor, that Pennsylvania cases have construed that if you're not in custody, you don't get Post-Conviction Relief Act relief. Mm-hmm. Following the completion and full service of his sentence for that conviction in the 80s, Mr. Koss got in trouble with the law again and was found guilty of assault and was sentenced to a separate term. The record indicates that the sentence for his earlier 1980s conviction and sentence was considered by the court. It doesn't quantify the extent to which it was considered. It was just noted by the court. That was found both by the district court and by the Third Circuit Court. Koss filed his petition pro se. His federal habeas corpus petition was filed pro se, and the district court, according due deference to his his federal habeas corpus petition, construed it as an attack on his later conviction in the 1990s, as well as an attack on his 1980s conviction, and denied Mr. Koss relief based upon the fact that although ineffective assistance of counsel was made to appear from the evidence, that Mr. Koss suffered no prejudice. Mr. Koss then appealed to the Third Circuit, and the Third Circuit reversed the district court, finding that prejudice was shown by Mr. Koss, and finding also, or ruling also, that because Koss's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in his 1980s conviction had an effect upon the sentence he received for his 1990s conviction, that he was entitled to federal habeas relief. And the means by which the Third Circuit reached that conclusion is the principal matter that I believe needs to be addressed here this morning, because what the Third Circuit did was relied principally upon jurisprudence developed in the Third Circuit, which, for all intents and purposes, reverses district court judges that don't treat attacks on subsequent convictions that were enhanced, sentences of which were enhanced by prior convictions. The Third Circuit reverses those judges and says you should have found that this collateral enhancement on grounds other than Gideon violations is something that that we will not tolerate in this circuit.
Mr. O'Malley, yes. You say in your brief that your argument is divided into two parts.
Yes, Your Honor.
One of them is the question left open in Malling against Cook as to whether the custody requirement of the federal statute is satisfied here.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the second is, what you've been talking about during most of your argument up to now. What kinds of claims may you make if the Malling question is decided against you? Now, are you going to say anything about the question left open in Malling against Cook, or are you going to leave that to your briefs?
I am going to say something about the question left open by Malling versus Cook. It is our position that the holding of Malling versus Cook has been misunderstood by the Third Circuit. The holding of Malling versus Cook clearly seems to say that a person may not attack, a person is not in custody under a prior conviction once he has fully served that conviction. But the Third Circuit reaches a different conclusion by looking at the result that was reached in Malang, because in Malang, the court will recall that the petitioner was granted relief, but in that case, the basis, as I read Malang, for the petitioner being granted relief was principally that there was a custodial nexus between the earlier conviction and sentence and that which he was attacking in his federal habeas corpus petition. That custodial nexus being a hold that was placed upon him for the state conviction that he would be obliged to serve. In this case, however, there is no custodial nexus to connect the fully expired sentence to the sentence that the court construed he was attacking in his federal habeas corpus petition.
How do you say there's no connection when the second sentence, the length of the second sentence, is determined by the fact that there was an earlier conviction?
Your Honor, yes, but I was talking about a custodial nexus, and I believe that the determinative factor in Malang versus Cook was the custodial nexus. I think the question of the simple enhancement.
Well, but
you
this
mean he was in custody on the prior conviction, not just because of the prior conviction. He was serving the sentence that had been imposed for the prior conviction. That's what the hold produced. Whereas in this case, he may well be serving additional time because of the prior conviction, but he is not serving the time of the prior conviction.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, that is our position.
Isn't it also the case in Malang that if the hold had not been placed, he would have been released under the prior conviction?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is the factor that I think the Third Circuit overlooked and overlooks in its holdings on cases of this type.
But even if this case is different from Malang, how can you say he was not in custody in this case? He's in prison.
He definitely is in custody in this case, Your Honor. He's in custody under a 1990 conviction.
Right. So the custody requirement of Section 2244 is satisfied.
Well, he wasn't attacking his 1990 conviction. He was attacking his 1984 conviction. There's nothing wrong with his 1990 conviction. The only thing wrong...
Well, if you're right on the merits, that's true. But if he's right, the thing that's wrong with it is that the length of the sentence was based on a prior unconstitutional violation of the federal Constitution.
That is...
If he's right, I don't know whether he is or not.
That would be correct. That would be a correct statement. But the court in Custis versus the United States adopted a line of reasoning which, while it may not directly apply to federal habeas cases, Custis having been a case under the Federal Sentencing Act, the rationale of those cases clearly seems to announce a constitutional declaration that in considering prior convictions and sentences, the only constitutional violation that the court will consider, the courts should consider, are Gideon violations, where counsel was totally absent, and that ineffective assistance of counsel cases do not fall under that umbrella, and therefore are not to be considered as supplying a basis for federal habeas attacks on subsequent convictions and sentences enhanced by a sentence in which there may have been ineffective assistance of counsel.
Would you say that rationale would apply even if the Pennsylvania court had acted within the time period and set aside the earlier conviction?
If the Pennsylvania court had acted within the time period and set aside the earlier conviction, we wouldn't have the problem, Your Honor, as I see it.
I think your rationale would be we shouldn't look at that regardless of whether there's merit to the earlier case or not. Would you agree then that the Third Circuit would have been correct in this case if after Mr. Koss had served his sentence, the Pennsylvania court, contrary to what you say the Pennsylvania law is, had decided, well, we will take a look at the earlier conviction, and we now conclude that he was not given effective assistance of counsel, supposing they entered such an order. Would that mean that the result in this case would be different?
I think that would mean the result in this case would be different because the only basis for complaint that Koss had in this case dealt only with the earlier conviction and sentence, not with his.
So then you're not saying that it's only a Gideon violation that gives rise to a claim. You're saying it's only an unresolved non-Gideon violation that gives rise.
I think
I don't know that I'm saying that, Your Honor.
I hope you're not. I assume in that hypothetical just posited, there would have been no basis for increasing the sentence. You could attack the second sentence on its face as being improper because there was no prior conviction.
No, I'm assuming the second sentence is entered before the Pennsylvania court rules. The second sentence is entered, then the Pennsylvania court rules that the first case is invalid. Would that mean the second case falls or wouldn't it?
I think it would certainly take a great deal of the weight out of the second case because it would.
But your basic position is only Gideon violations count. That's what I understood your argument to be. And I'm suggesting we have a non-Gideon violation that set aside the first conviction after the second sentence was imposed. Would you count it or not? It's not a Gideon violation.
I think we would count it, but I think that count would come only on the basis of comity, on the basis of the federal court giving due recognition to what Pennsylvania had done with its own.
Well, these are all Pennsylvania sentences, are they not, that we're talking about?
Yes,
here?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
If the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had set aside the first sentence, surely the Pennsylvania courts would recognize the fact that it was no longer valid.
That is correct, Your Honor.
You don't have to get any federal habeas there.
That's why I'm having trouble with the question, because you really don't have to get to federal habeas there. I think the basis for federal habeas would evaporate in that situation.
My hypothetical is just the opposite. My hypothetical is that they set aside the first sentence, but they didn't set aside the second one. We had a case like that not long ago.
Well, I think the answer to that hypothetical, then, Your Honor, would depend upon the extent to which the second sentence was actually enhanced.
Well, I'm assuming it was. It was enhanced an extra year because of the prior conviction. The court now knows the first conviction was invalid, but it decides, well, we think he really did it anyway, so we're going to leave the second sentence in place.
Grounds
for federal habeas relief.
We do not have that basis in this case because the courts have recognized that in the second sentencing, the first conviction and sentence were considered, but there's no way to quantify the extent to which, if any, enhancement actually took place.
You have to deal with his hypothetical. And don't you have to acknowledge at least a second exception besides utter absence of counsel and the second sentence being that, in fact, the prior conviction has, by the jurisdiction that imposed it, been held to be invalid?
If the second sentence was held invalid by the jurisdiction which imposed it, we have the question of comity, which I think would oblige the federal courts to give the appropriate deference to that one situation.
Well, let's go one step further and ask what happens if the defendant has done everything he can to get a resolution on the validity of the first conviction. And through no fault of the defendants, the state refuses to deal with the question. And nonetheless, in the second proceeding, reliance is placed on the first conviction that the defendant has tried to challenge but couldn't. That comes closer to this case.
It comes closer to this case, Your Honor, and I would say that in that situation, the only basis for federal relief that the defendant would have would be a Gideon violation, utilizing the rationale that was expressed by this court in Custis versus the United States. And at Gideon violations, the court has drawn the line.
Well, Custis acknowledged that a Gideon violation still was open, but did it necessarily conclude that there is no other exception?
I think it did. It says Custis asks us to extend the rule to cases other than Gideon violations, and this the court refuses to do.
But if assume that there was some constitutional violation in the first conviction, You say the defendant can be deprived by the state of any chance to correct that?
No, I'm...
And the subsequent court can use the unconstitutionally obtained prior conviction to enhance the later sentence?
What I'm saying is the vehicle of federal habeas corpus is not available to examine into the collateral effect of any deprivations other than Gideon violations.
But, you know, in Custis, one of the values that the court was basing its decision on was the value of finality. And it said comity requires us to respect that finality.
Yes, sir.
And you are now saying that that same value, and hence the same comity concern, would be implicated when a state, in effect, says, we are going to stonewall a constitutional claim, even though that claim is brought within the time period that our law specifies for it. And you're saying the result should be the same. Do you really think the values involved are the same values that Custis respected?
If we had a situation where the state actually did say, we are going to stonewall, I think we would have an entirely different...
So that the only distinction between that case and this case is that the state was simply silent and did nothing, as opposed to announcing in advance that it would do nothing. That's the only distinction.
That's the principal distinction, coupled with the passage of time and the expiration of the sentence.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Mr. Russell, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, we believe that this case is controlled by the constitutional principle announced by this Court in Custis. Custis found that it is permissible to enhance a defendant's sentence with prior convictions that were themselves infected with constitutional error. And because that's so, a prisoner may not bring a habeas corpus attack under 2254 on his current sentence and hope to reopen the validity of his prior convictions, except when the prior convictions are obtained in violation of Gideon.
Mr. Russell, there was a factor in Custis itself that the forum that rendered the judgment that was considered defective was still open. And it seemed to me an example of the ordinary rule that you go back where the judgment was rendered if that door is still open.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe that Custis does express a preference for the forum, which is to say that all these constitutional attacks need to be made in the rendering state or in the habeas corpus petition that follows while the defendant is in custody. So while Custis, in that particular case, the Court recognized that a habeas corpus avenue was available, that observation was premised on the underlying observation that he was still in custody and could go back to his home state and attack his convictions there. Otherwise, once the convictions are final and the defendant is not in custody, the only violation that the defendant can raise in a complaint about his prior conviction is that the prior conviction was obtained in violation of Gideon.
Well, is it irrelevant then?
In this case, the person in custody is in the position where he simply can't get a state collateral review. There could have been another case in all respects similar to this petitioner, with the one difference that a week before, his custody in the state for the first sentence, a week before the custody expired, the state Supreme Court said, "Oh, you're right. There's a constitutional violation." It seems rather quixotic to deprive the petitioner of that opportunity here, simply because his sentence was served before the court got around to ruling on the issue.
I have two observations for you, Justice Kennedy. First, we believe that the petitioner in this case could actually have obtained relief, review of his earlier case while he was in custody. Now, admittedly, the state courts do not, under the Alhorn case, the answer to Justice O'Connor's question was in our brief, the green brief, at page 3 on footnote 3, there's the case of Pennsylvania against Alhorn, and that's the authority for the proposition that once the petitioner is released from custody in Pennsylvania, he cannot bring a PCR attack on his sentence. I think what it amounts to is that Pennsylvania...
He couldn't file it, but could it be resolved if he had previously filed it while in custody? That's the question.
I believe not, Your Honor. I believe that essentially Pennsylvania...
Well, then my question stands.
Yes, it does. And the ultimate thing is that irrespective of what Pennsylvania law would do, the imminent release of the prisoner from custody would have allowed him to file a habeas corpus petition under 2254 while he was still in custody, and he would have had an excellent argument under futility that he wouldn't be able to exhaust his state remedies and could have achieved a federal review of his Strickland claim back in the rendering state. Now,
You mean you could file a federal habeas corpus action saying, you know, my custody is about to expire, this state court is a little slow, it's time for you to get into this? I've never heard. I think we would immediately say that it's been unexhausted.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the question for that...
That's a strange proposition.
I think the question would be whether the state remedies were going to be availing at that point, and if, in fact, the state remedies were going to be concluded a week later because of state law, then I thought the petitioner would have an avenue for relief under the federal habeas corpus while he was in custody. Even if that's wrong, even assuming for the sake of argument that I'm wrong about that, and I think there will be...
Well, excuse me, before, would that federal relief still be available when he was out of custody? Can you get 2254 when the custody is over?
No, Your Honor.
Wouldn't you face the same problem in the federal habeas court that you faced in the state habeas court?
If he had filed, Your Honor, his petition while he was in custody in federal court, then under this court's mootness analysis of Carafas against Lavallee and Cibron against New York, the case would not be moot and the court would have jurisdiction to consider the merits of the petition even though he had been released from custody, precisely because this court is concerned about the future possibility of collateral consequences.
What is the Pennsylvania law? Leave all this federal law out of it. But Pennsylvania has some kind of a guideline system. So if you come into a federal court, the defendant's convicted, he's now going to be sentenced, he has a prior conviction obtained 30 years ago when he was robbing some chicken coops, he would like to say that confession was beaten out of me, it's totally wrong, can he do it? Or does the judge, like the federal system after Custis, just say we won't even listen?
I believe, Your Honor, that under the Pennsylvania law, the judge says we won't even listen. I think that's the way it works in Pennsylvania. And so our rule definitely, by calling for application of the Custis principle, we certainly think that this may exclude some defendants from achieving relief in state court first. But we think that the line drawn in Custis is a fair and equitable balancing of the competing concerns between fairness and finality, and it's certainly a rule that can be applied uniformly throughout the states. I would like to point out that, in substance, our position tracks very closely the argument advanced by the United States last month in the Daniels case. And while we think the government's right there, we believe that this case presents even stronger reasons for application of the Custis principle. One chief difference is that, whereas in Daniels, this case came to us through an application of a mandatory sentence enhancement scheme, this involved the discretionary use of a prior conviction by a sentencing court, and that's something that happens much more often, happens in every sentencing court in the country every single day. And so to the extent the Custis majority was motivated by concerns about finality and of the burden of conducting endless derivative collateral attacks, those concerns are implicated to a far greater degree here. It would simply be unworkable if we had to go investigate Strickland claims about trials that took place in a different state many years ago every time a prior conviction was used in a discretionary proceeding.
Why wouldn't that be taken care of if you had a requirement you have to show cause and prejudice for not knocking it out earlier? You're talking about stale evidence, and if you had a requirement that the petitioner had to present it at the earliest opportunity, then we wouldn't have the problem of people coming in 20 years later when they could have come in 2 years later. So why doesn't your horribles, why isn't the answer to that simply we put a timeliness requirement on?
Well, because certainly the cause and prejudice, I think that even with a cause and prejudice rule, there will be defendants who are trying to raise the validity of their prior convictions many years after the fact. Perhaps they were precluded because state law didn't allow the attack. Perhaps they only learned of the violation late, as in the case of a Brady or a newly discovered evidence rule. And in all of those cases, we'll be opening up a collateral review, often in a different state, and trying to discuss the relevance or the reliability of a prior conviction that was obtained many years earlier.
You'll have cause and prejudice proceedings.
Yes.
As a regular matter.
Yes.
Evidence claimed to have been found later.
Yes.
It's too late to do it and so forth.
And the burden of that litigation would just add to the same litigation problems we're going to have. A second difference between our case and the Daniels case is that there's a federalism component here that was not present in Daniels. We think it's one thing for the federal system to say to the states, we will not use your convictions for our sentencing purposes, but it's quite a different thing for the federal system to say, you may not use your convictions for your sentencing purposes. And finally, we note that from the transcript of the Daniels argument, some members of the court at least entertained the possibility that the text of 2255 may allow for collateral attacks on grounds that are themselves not mandated by the Constitution. And to the extent that's a possibility, we think that's a difference in our case as well, because this court repeatedly has stated that 2254 exists solely to remedy errors of constitutional dimension. In short, we believe that this application of the Custis rule would be totally proper here because it is a workable rule, and that the respondent's position, in contrast, is totally unworkable. It would subject us to endless collateral reviews, and we would ask that the Third Circuit be reversed on that ground. While I have a few moments, I do want to approach my first issue and explain why this court can and should address the main issue, even though we've raised what appears to be a jurisdictional defect. When we looked at this case following this court's decision in Malang, we expected to see the habeas corpus litigation follow a particular pattern, which was that the defendant would exhaust his state remedies, and then he would bring a habeas petition styled as an attack on the new conviction, complaining about the use of the old conviction. But what we saw instead was something that was quite different. The defendant here never raised this issue in state court. He brought his petition while his — excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Mr. Wade, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, there are three reasons why this Court should permit federal habeas review of Mr. Costa's sentence. First, there's a constitutional interest in reliability at sentencing. Second, federal habeas corpus review is necessary to protect that interest. And third, the state interests are adequately protected by the habeas corpus doctrines of procedural default, exhaustion, and burden of proof.
Turning to my — Could you give us some background information? Did your client file a direct appeal from the 86 conviction and sentence?
I do not see that in the record, Your Honor. It appears that there's some evidence that he asked his counsel to, but I don't believe —
We assume, then, that no direct appeal was filed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the only relief from that 86 sentence that was requested was the state post-conviction relief petition that was filed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that was filed while he was in custody under the 86 proceeding?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And was an answer filed to that?
Yes, there was.
And nothing else happened? Is that it? He was released from custody?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And no further action was taken?
No further action.
And why is that? Do we know?
We do not know from this record. We don't know why.
Is that typical in Pennsylvania that these things languish for years at a time?
I wouldn't call it typical. It does happen that various post-trial motions to modify sentences do not.
Did the Pennsylvania courts lose jurisdiction to consider the post-conviction relief petition once he was discharged from custody?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
That is the Pennsylvania law.
That is — Pennsylvania law clearly forecloses this.
So this man had no — it was final.
It was final.
As a matter of Pennsylvania law at the time of the 1990 charges.
Yes, it was. Turning to my first point about the constitutional interest in reliability at sentencing, Mr. Koss had the burden of proving that his prior conviction was unreliable. He did.
Why does the Constitution of the United States stop a state from saying, for example, for the future, not for the past, new law, if you commit an assault and if you have a bad, violence-prone disciplinary record in high school, you're going to get a longer sentence?
There's nothing that would prevent us.
All right. Well, is there anything preventing a state from saying, if you are convicted of an assault and you have an arrest record, you're going to get a longer sentence?
You can make such a law. I think that you always have to have the availability to show that the later sentence was not. Well, I didn't expect that the later sentence wasn't improperly enhanced by an invalid crime.
No, I'm saying the law is, if you commit an assault in the future, mm-hmm. and you are a person who's been arrested several times, you're going to get a higher sentence.
And some they do that by state recidivist statutes, and those are.
Is that all right?
That's okay.
Okay. If that's all right, then what's wrong about saying, if you are going to commit an assault, and you are a person who has on his record some convictions, we no more care about whether those convictions were right or wrong than we do about whether the arrest was right or wrong, than we do about whether the discipline in high school was right or wrong. We're just saying if you are a person like that and you commit a crime in the future, you will get a higher sentence. And why could that be unconstitutional if the first or not?
The reason it's unconstitutional, and where I guess I would depart from the statutory scheme, is that there has to be a place to litigate the constitutional issue. And the
Why does there have to be? Or saying constitutionality of that earlier offense is for purposes of your present crime totally irrelevant, says the state. All we're interested in is whether you are a person who has written down on a piece of paper somewhere three words, conviction, conviction, conviction. And if you're that kind of a person and you go out and commit another crime, you will get a higher sentence. We don't care whether it was constitutional or not, any more than we care about whether the arrest was right or wrong or the disciplinary record.
Then I would say that statute's unconstitutional. I think
Are the others unconstitutional, too?
Yes, if that's
because?
Because there has to be a forum to litigate the reliability principle.
In other words, the Constitution of the United States requires a state to litigate the accuracy of any fact upon which it bases a sentence?
The Constitution of the United States doesn't want people sentenced on their subsequent cases on misinformation of a constitutional magnitude, the Tucker principles.
What if, following up Justice Breyer's hypothesis, what if the state says that this conviction has been set aside, but one of our guidelines says we can take into consideration prior acts, prior similar acts. And we now say that this conviction represented prior acts, whether or not you were convicted. Is there anything wrong with that?
I would say if it's misinformation of a constitutional magnitude.
We're not talking about constitutional magnitude. Okay. The state says here we have a witness, and the same witness that came forth at the trial says, yes, he did slug this guy and slugged him five times. And the defendant is allowed to contest that in the sentencing proceeding. But the judge says, well, I find as a fact that you did slug the guy, and so I'm taking that into consideration in sentencing. Is there anything wrong with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, Your Honor.
Now, here, as I understand it, the defendant had an opportunity to appeal from the 1986 conviction and sentence and did not do so, as far as this record discloses.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, why isn't that the end of the matter, then?
Well, normally ineffectiveness claims, you'd have the same attorney on appeal, and you would normally bring the ineffectiveness claims in post-conviction proceedings in Pennsylvania. We're basing our...
You see what I was worried about? I'm worried about new Jackson v. Deno line of cases now applying to sentences.
We're suggesting that you cannot use invalid misinformation of a constitutional magnitude, inaccurate information, based on the cases of Tucker, Burke, Townsend versus Burke, Burkett, in sentencing proceedings, because you don't want to sentence someone that's may not be really guilty of a prior.
Both were all failure to appoint counsel cases, were they not?
They were, Your Honor. That's correct. But they also have been read to include a broader principle of...
But read by this court?
Disputed, I think, by this court. I mean, there's some of this court that would hold it strictly to the Sixth Amendment.
Well, I mean, majority opinions of the court?
The majority opinion seem to hold it to Sixth Amendment, I think. But if we're going to have a due process principle, a fairness principle at sentencing, then that interest has to come down to reliability through fundamental fairness. Mr. Koss proved that his attorney did not interview witnesses at his 1986 case, did not subpoena them to trial, and the Third Circuit found that the result would have been different had he not had those things been done, had he received effective assistance of counsel. The state's interest, there's a lot of worry about protecting the state's interest, and that's a legitimate worry, but all this court would have to be doing would be balancing the state's interests and the defendant's interest in reliability.
Koss has had a string of convictions, hasn't he? Mm-hmm.
He has had a string of convictions, Your Honor. If you refer to his juvenile record forward. This is a limited right. We're not asking for a broad principle. It applies to constitutional claims and constitutional claims that go to reliability. They may not necessarily — all constitutional claims will not fall within this rubric. And the issue of which claims do and which claims don't are not at issue here. We're here on a Strickland claim, which is as close as you can get to a Gideon claim. Mr. Koss has tried to do everything he could possibly do to remedy this situation by filing a state post-conviction. And then he finds himself in the Pennsylvania legal system as being foreclosed from raising it at the next sentencing and on post-conviction. He's done everything he can do, and if he doesn't get raise this issue in federal habeas corpus, he gets to litigate it nowhere. And I submit that his sentence for the 1990 conviction would be improper. It's on the basis of an improper, valid conviction.
Well, if that's what's driving us, I mean, is you think the best remedy is to simply open up all of these convictions to subsequent federal habeas corpus? Why not just, if this is the horrible event that we're trying to avoid, why not just adopt a constitutional rule that it is not proper for a state to foreclose habeas corpus relief? You say that's the only practical way to challenge ineffective assistance. It's just not constitutional for a state that forecloses habeas corpus relief to use it in subsequent sentence enhancement. That'd be a lot easier than
It may be easier, but I don't believe the Constitution requires the states to have a post-conviction process at all. So from that standpoint, I don't see how we could have
Well, but you're saying that there's something unconstitutional about sentencing on the basis of a prior sentence that could not be challenged in state habeas.
Okay,
so just say the state sentence is simply unconstitutional. You cannot use that prior conviction when there's been no ability to challenge it in habeas.
Well, I think that
I'd much rather do that than muck up federal habeas corpus.
I see that we're not mucking up federal habeas corpus, that the way that we're applying the same rules in federal habeas corpus to sentence enhancement type cases, and we're used to applying those rules. And those rules protect state interests, such as exhaustion, procedural default, and burden of proof. Much of the digging up of the record is going to be on the petitioner.
Well, but it requires federal courts to look into the matter. The rule that I proposed would require the states to do the job themselves.
And
be a much more efficient way to handle it, seems to me.
I think, Your Honor, that what will happen is that we are going to see a California claim in a Pennsylvania federal court. You're going to have the problems of that the state that's involved with the process is not there. But I think that the problem with that is solved by limiting the remedy to the sentence, so that for the purposes, if Pennsylvania federal court declared a California conviction unconstitutional because of a sentencing in Pennsylvania, then it applies just to that sentencing. It cannot really invalidate.
Inquiry still is a very difficult inquiry for a federal court in California to make.
It would be very
much more easy for a Pennsylvania court to make.
It may be difficult, but that difficulty will be on the on the petitioner. He'll have to respond to that initially when he files his habeas corpus petition.
What is the law? I'm asking this. I'm interested in your view. That is, a state prisoner goes into federal habeas court and he says, one of the reasons I got a longer sentence was because somebody thought that I hit one of the bystanders. But I want to tell you there's no evidence of that at all in the record. None. Zero. Can he get federal habeas relief from that extra sentence?
Yes, I think he can get federal habeas relief from that extra sentence. I think Tucker...
Same principle as a conviction? I've never seen one.
Well, I don't know that if the court would have to make some kind of finding, like in Grayson, where they said, I heard you testify on the witness stand, and you testified falsely, and I'm going to enhance your sentence by 5 years because of that testimony. I mean, in that type of situation, then if we knew that it affected the sentence, I think I could answer that question the way I did. Yes. In summary, we seek a limited and narrow rule. We seek a rule that will require the petitioner or Mr. Koss to exhaust his state claims to meet his burden of proof. And when you have a case where he's met his burden of proof, has shown that his counsel was ineffective, and has shown that the subsequent sentence was enhanced or at least influenced by the prior improper conviction, that this court should not base the sentence upon that. They should not let a sentence be founded on an unreliable foundation, and that the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. The case is submitted.